I do revel in how storytelling, which so often we think is a fictional or an imaginary concept, but it isn't. Storytelling is about how we interact with each other, how we empathize with one another, how we learn about each other. And so our real stories are the things that evolve into being able to be a story that you then share with other people.
Welcome to episode 62, our third ever panel show, where I am delighted to introduce my dear friend and humanist celebrant extraordinaire, Zina Birch. But before we introduce her, let's, Renee, take a look back over the last month. How's your January been?
It's been busy, and it's been a little bit of weather up and down, which totally affects my moods, actually, I've really noticed. Sunshine and cold, gorgeous. Grey and drizzly, not so happy.
Yeah, I feel that. It's been a long old January. Did you know that everybody in the UK should take vitamin D between the months of October and April?
No, I didn't.
Well, you probably should. It affects all things like digestion, mental health, energy, sleep, lots of important things. And this time last year, I went to the doctor and they took my blood test and said that I was vitamin D deficient. And then she said, everyone is vitamin D deficient between those months in the UK. And it's particularly bad if you have brown skin because your body's not good at processing the little sunlight that we do get. So top tip for everybody is that they should take their vitamin D throughout these months to help get them through.
You know I love nutrients and all things to do with the body, so
I do know that.
Top tip.
I do. And thanks to your SCOBY, I have my very own kombucha, which has been an absolute revelation.
So we probably should say that I pronounce it Scooby, but I am Australian.
Oh, okay. Like a pasty.
Yeah, exactly.
In joke for
like
anyone
yogurt,
who's listened.
Like pasta. But I gave you a Scooby for your birthday.
You did. And, you know, I've basically become a Scooby mum and it's great. And I've been nurturing it. We made two batches. I actually meant to bring you some, but I will do next time. And I feel like my gut bacteria thanks you every day that I drink.
Thank yourself. You're the Scooby mum.
That's true. What have been your highlights of January?
Personal highlights. I've been asked to contribute to an annual book that invites women artists to create a piece of work in response to another female artist that's either inspired or influenced their work. And it was really flattering to be asked. And I've just had such a great time working on this. It's reminded me how important it is to make sure I tap back into my creativity, because I've been so busy doing so much admin, you know, setting up podcasts, creating the percent events, all those kind of things. And it was like a really big reminder I need to create to keep feeling energized.
Definitely. And do you want to give a quick overview of how the greater than 11% event went last month?
Yeah, so we had our first event on the 8th of January. It was so amazing. It was so fantastic. There was a lot of nerves on my part early on. But yeah, Ursie and I welcomed a lovely 10 guests, which was so nice. Some people we knew, and like in the nicest possible way, some randos that just found us on Eventbrite. And it was such a lovely group. The first half was doing found footage loops with 16mm film, which is part of my artistic practice. And then we heard from Karen Cunningham and Tatiana Telly, and they talked about their careers and working in the industry. Tatiana's a videographer and Karen Cunningham is a director for commercials. So yeah, it was really great. It was such a great night. In fact, we were pushing people out the door, weren't we? I'm looking at Ursie. She's nodding.
That's amazing. And the first one is done now, so that is a great launch pad now for the events to follow. Have you got another one planned?
Yes, so the next one's coming up on the 4th of March and we're going to start promoting that early Feb.
Excellent. So all you brilliant creative listeners out there, make sure you mark the 4th of March in your diary for the next Greater Than 11% event.
There's only 15 tickets, people. Getting quick.
Excellent. My highlights from January, there are a couple that I thought were noteworthy. I had my back cracked at an osteopath, which was literally the best feeling ever.
It's amazing.
It's slightly addictive.
I've
been really like chasing that feeling ever since. And obviously I can't like maneuver myself into that same position, so happy and sad. Other highlights included I hosted the Marketing Academy final boot camp of the cohort, which was really amazing, because when I went there I was actually in quite a bad place. I was feeling really, really low. I think the weather has also contributed to me feeling awful, and the busyness and all the stuff that you were mentioning that doesn't feel like you're living to your higher intention, to quote Jen from her podcast, just really got on top of me. But we do a practice called The Living Leader, where you talk about your stand and like this time next year, what you want to be doing and how and why. There was a lot of crying involved, but it was so amazing to be with a group of people who I hadn't met before, but who were also open and vulnerable and kind, and really kind of made me remember the magic of Marketing Academy. And it was just beautiful to be with such an incredible group of people. And finally, something I thought you would be particularly interested in, I booked my writing retreat.
Oh, yay! That's such great news!
Yeah, so anyone who listens to this, now you can all hold me accountable to actually writing my book with the prize money that I got from the Wacol Future Leaders Award. So that's very exciting.
Oh, that's so good. So when is that booked in for?
That is April, okay. The week after Easter. It's a full week in Devon, in a place with no Wi-Fi.
That's going to be heaven.
A tutored retreat. I'm very excited about that. Anyone who listened to our last panel episode will remember us talking about New Year's resolutions and setting great intentions, and just thought it was worth reflecting on that because they have all gone completely out of the window. So instead, I'm pinning all of my hopes on February now.
You've got the whole year for New Year's resolutions.
Exactly.
They don't need to be achieved in 31 days.
Exactly. January has just been a real slog of a month. And the great thing about February is that there are fewer days in it than the rest of the month. So it is a great day to set yourself unachievable goals or achievable goals. Who knows?
Well, you've got an extra day this year.
Yes, that is true. Great point. That is true.
So all those goals can be achieved on that day.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's exactly what will happen. So we would love to hear how your January has been, any moments of great joy or achievements, or whether you're having a tough time. We're here for you and would love to hear it. And just know that it's okay to not be okay if it's been a tough month for you, because there is the rest of the year. And I have personally found that I put an unrealistic set of expectations upon January, which has not delivered, and life feels the same as it did in 2019. But we are constant works in progress. So, you know, be kind to yourself if you haven't been so far.
And I just want to reiterate, you've got another 11 months.
Exactly. And, you know, beyond that as well, yeah, because, you know, the year turning over is an arbitrary is an arbitrary milestone, as we described in the last panel. So what struck you, Renee, from the last four episodes? We've had some absolute corkers over the last few weeks.
Yeah, and such a range of women, which we always have. But yeah, I think January, in terms of going off with a boom, the podcast definitely has. So we had the incredible Jen Clark. Oh my gosh, like what a woman, what an energy. I mean, I was hanging on to the coattails of the conversation. She processes and thinks and talks so quickly. And she just had done and achieved so many incredible things, starting out in printmaking and now working in strategy. Yeah, really passionate person, and so great to kind of spend a good hour just chatting about what she's achieved and her current role.
Yeah, I thought she was incredible on so many levels. I really like how she, in a really non-forced way, made a brilliant connection between printmaking and data, in the way that she said, you know, 70% of both practices are about the preparation. So with data, it's about getting the data into the right shape, cleaning it, making sure that things are consistent, and the same with printmaking. And then 20% of it is analysis on the data side or work, and then it's just the final 10%, which is in the presentation. And I really loved that, because sometimes those analogies can be a little bit forced, but it felt so authentic with her. And I was also just absolutely obsessed with the way that she talked about her spirit totem of Serena Winfrey, combining fierceness and spiritual serenity and the grace of Oprah. I was like, yes, she is an amazing woman. And I love how she has thought so intentionally about these things, and she just seems like one of those people who actually does stuff rather than just like reading quotes about it. You know, she did that amazing course to get closer to her higher intention and all that kind
of
stuff. Where she died. I know.
That was so full on. Yeah.
Yeah.
And she definitely, she's so purposeful, and I love that she has a board that she goes to, which is made up of previous peers or bosses or mentors and friends, and she runs past career life decisions and she talks it through. It just like totally, I was like, I need a board. I need a big board.
Yeah, that was, I thought she was incredible. And then the next guest was
Davina Ajana, who is an amazing creative consultant who has just set up her business and launched it this year, called Lemons Me Brand Consultancy. And she is such a generous, nurturing person. Like, I literally felt like I was in the room with someone that you could definitely talk to about any idea, and she would hold it, nurture it, see it through and deliver. And yeah, I know her business is going to be booming because she's just so passionate, and she really wants to work with people, small to medium businesses, startups, because she knows that's her strength, is this nurturing and giving people space and time to allow them to design and brand their business.
And I think that links quite nicely to Jane's episode where she talked about being the truffle hog for Channel 4, going around finding these small pieces of creative genius and really nurturing them, giving the space to live and breathe and giving them a home somewhere within Channel 4. I thought as well the journey she talked about that Channel 4 had been on around raising awareness around menopause was so powerful, and it really inspired me actually. And I really genuinely thought, wow, Channel 4 must be an incredible place to work, especially when she so honestly said that her values were so reflected in the company that she worked for, that it felt like a really natural fit. And she seems as well so quickly to have established herself within the kind of cultural fabric of that organisation, despite being relatively new, which I thought was really impressive.
Jane is such a beautiful person. I just love talking to her. You can really see that she's really focused on supporting creativity, and that's her role. She did email me when the podcast went live last week and said, I don't think anyone's said truffle hog on your podcast before, which is so lovely. But yeah, I just loved the time we spent with her. It was just really lovely learning what she does, and also how focused she is, and talking about empathy and business and kindness. And sometimes kindness is a hard-nosed decision for the greater good of the team. Mm. And that's, you know, I think something that you can really reflect on and take away, that sometimes decisions are tough, but actually they're for the right reason.
Yeah, absolutely. She was wonderful. And then finally we had Kate Jessup. And something that resonated with me was her talking about how she felt like a fraud, saying that she was being described as a writer publicly because she hadn't been trained in something, which I thought was interesting. It made me reflect on the fact that when I do talks on communications and behaviour change at conferences, I always caveat it by saying, well, I'm not professionally trained like any of you in this room, or I don't have any qualifications on it. This is just from my experience, almost to denigrate the value of my experience. And I reflected that I thought it was ridiculous that she kind of balked at the idea that she couldn't be described as a writer. And then I thought, I'm not going to say that again, that I don't have a right to be talking about something because I don't have a qualification.
Yeah, I agree. And she's been such on an evolution, her creative path. And like, you can trace the path, but it's really changed over time. I also love that the reason that she gave why she wasn't a writer is because she types with two fingers.
I know, I love that.
And I was like, still writing.
I know. I absolutely love that. It's interesting. I was chatting to somebody about an application that they wanted to put in a few days ago, and they said, oh, I don't really like, you know, self-promotion, and I find it really awkward to talk about myself on camera. And I said, okay, well, did you have any issue with submitting your CV as part of this application? And she said, oh, no, that was fine. And I was like, okay, well, if it's all based on fact, then it's not self-promotion. You're just articulating your accomplishments. There's nothing braggy or self-promoting about that. And you should try and unpick why you feel that way. So I think there's something that we kind of sometimes hide behind certificates or qualifications, whereas we should get comfortable in talking about them, being proud of them.
Yeah, and it's hard. I totally get that. It's walking that fine line of, I'm really proud of my achievements, but not feeling weirdly, like a weird shame for talking about it. And I think that comes into play a lot. It's just something you have to personally work through.
Definitely. I mean, it's not bragging if it's based on facts, right? And I think something like, I can't remember the exact statistic, but women who are seen to be self-promoting of themselves in the workplace are commonly disliked by men and women. So there's a real stigma against being able to confidently articulate your achievements, and something that we all need to kind of recognize and change our own ways. Like, often it's easy to hear that and feel jealous or feel like, oh, that person's, you know, really confident about talking about themselves, or they're bragging, but actually trying to understand that what it's doing to you to make you have that reaction rather than pulling them down.
And just bragging about others' achievements. I love that. I love talking about what other people achieve.
Me too.
Yeah, and it just makes it more, it normalizes it, and we should all be doing that for each other.
Exactly. Shine theory at work. So, what has caught your eye from the industry this month, Renee?
The thing that stood out, I think, which stands out every year, is the Golden Globes. And again, no nominations for female directors. Poor show, Golden Globes, yet again. It's been pointed out by several women on the awards night, and several men, actually. And just disappointing that we're at that point when we've actually got so many more female directors now making mainstream blockbusters.
And what do you think could or should be done about it?
Well, I'd be interested to know who's making up the judging panel for those. I think that would be, I'd love to see some transparency around that and see why it is. Because there's been some cracking films.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make sense.
If anybody knows or has a way.
I think it gets distracted on the night, because Ricky Gervais was the host this year, and it was intense, like intense. And he called out a lot of big people on their associations with people that are quite unsavory, put it kindly. So it'll be different, I imagine, next year, because they're going to have Tina Fey and Amy Poehler doing the presenting. So yeah, hopefully that starts moving it and feeling it towards maybe we might actually get some nominations for female directors next year.
Yeah, definitely. There's a similarity with the thing that caught my eye over the last month from an industry perspective, which is that eMarketer published their Digital Trends for 2020 report, whereby it got attention for all the wrong reasons, in that all of its 21 contributors were all men and mostly white. And it is bewildering that today that could happen. But something brilliant that happened as a result of it is the wonderful agency called Liberty, run by the amazing CEO Alex Goat, had a response to this, and they put together a report based on contributions of some fantastic women. And Alex Go, in her LinkedIn post, mentioned that it took her less than 6 hours to engage over 35 brilliant women in the industry. And so for any journalist who's short of women to ask for comment on the industry, the content that they put out should uncover new trends and new contributors and a new pool of expert opinions to access for the future. So that was a great response to a quite disappointing report from eMarketer.
And the industry as a whole did actually jump on it, I would say, straight away. I mean, that's great that people were calling it out immediately.
Yeah, absolutely.
And loads is being done about that. It is weird, though. Like, if you compiled that and you looked at it, you'd be like, ooh.
But
I would. I'd be like, okay, hold on. I just need to think about this.
But I think to your point about the Golden Globes, what's the composition of eMarketer as a business? Because actually, if you're in an organization which isn't particularly diverse, then looking at that list of contributors, that list of photos or names actually might not seem that strange to you. So yeah, I completely agree. The first question I wanted to ask was, how is the eMarketer management team or public editorial team, what's the composition of men and women within that for that to happen? So yeah, I think great response from Liberty there. Well done putting that together. And, you know, it's something great happened from something that was quite disappointing. But now, enough reflecting on January. Let's look forward to February. And because it is February, as I mentioned at the beginning, it is with just the utmost joy and pleasure that I would like to introduce Zena to our third panel episode of Greater Than 11%. And in fact, Zena was the lady who married me and Chris last year.
I did have that honour.
She is Cornish, descended from a pirate. No, she's not Cornish.
Cornish and Devonshire.
Okay.
The Devon side of my family would be cross if I just said Cornish. The Cornish side of my family wants to deny the Devonshire.
Okay. Before I let her introduce herself, I thought I'd say a few interesting facts about her. She studied at Goldsmiths and then the Central School of Speech and Drama. She ran a theatre company for 3 years, and in the course of that, some friends asked her to marry them, and her life changed direction ever since. She has been obsessed with storytelling, and She also has what I consider to be the most sensuous voice and joyous energy. So I am very excited to have her on this panel show, mainly because I'll probably just listen to it a gazillion times afterwards because I love the sound of your voice so much. And also because it's a great privilege for me to introduce you as a friend, as well as the person who married me and Chris, and therefore forever be a part of my personal life journey. So welcome, Zena, to the panel.
Thank you for having me. Hello.
Hi.
I'm now very, very conscious of my voice and probably don't agree.
Well, but you should be. It's a great voice.
Thank you kindly.
How has your January been?
I was listening to your Januaries with interest because January is quite a different beast for me, because essentially living in a fairly seasonal job, which isn't always the case because it changes from year to year, but there's almost always a month of the year where I don't have to work to quite such a tight deadline as I do the rest of the year. And for me this year, that was January. So I've had a genuinely glorious January. I thought that I would probably do less, and it turns out I've done more. I managed to see all the people that I end up having to say, oh, I'll try and see you, I'll try and see you. I've managed to catch up with all of my honorary nieces and nephews and my godchildren and my friends. And I also invented a ceremony in the first week of January, which felt very much like a precursor to how the decade might end up falling out in front of me. It was very exciting, a ceremony that essentially evolved from a necessity. And I'm very happy to tell you more about that, but I should probably explain a little bit about what I do before I do that, so that gives it context.
That is a brilliant idea, and indeed a question that we do ask all of our guests is exactly what it is that you do and what it is that being a humanist celebrant entails.
It's quite important that we use all the right letters in that, because I've been mistaken once before when introduced as a humorless celibate, which is very much not what I am. A humanist celebrant basically helps people to notate moments in time that are important to them, often things that are heightened emotional states, so rites of passage basically. So as you well know, I predominantly work as a wedding celebrant, but I also work with people across all of the very traditional markers. So if you have a baptism in a religious community, what we can have as a sort of secular alternative is a naming. That's something that I work with as well, and also funerals. They're predominantly, as I say, rites of passage. And humanists aren't anti-religious, it's just a non-religious stance. And in an ever-growing secular society, you find there's more of a need for it. And also, a lot of the time, people believe that ceremony holds its place within a religious context, but actually that's not true. When you look in a lovely nerdy fashion into where the origins of ceremony come from, they cross all cultures and it crosses all time, and therefore it's very much a human need. And so it's very easy to find how to express these rites of passage if you belong to a particular cultural heritage. But if you find yourself, as many of us do now, perhaps not particularly in one religious stance or another, or completely atheist or agnostic or who knows what you are, there's still moments that you want to annotate. And that's where a humanist celebrant comes along.
That's amazing. And I actually feel like I want to celebrate like every single moment that I can, just to see more of you in my life and have that annotated in some way. Maybe I'll have you celebrate my every single birthday that I have for the rest of my life as a single moment. And in case people can't hear it in your voice, why do you love it?
I came to this by accident rather than by design. And I think often when you find yourself in an environment that you have found yourself in accidentally, it's because almost without meaning to, everything you did before it was preparing you. I get to work with people at points at which they are invested, I guess. So I also manage to work with people in a way where I ask them why. And I think my job is probably the nicest, because that's the angle that I like to take in the way that I do it. Celebrants all work differently. But for me, it's about being able to ask people why it is that they want to express whatever it is. It's quite obvious in certain ones. With a funeral, you're celebrating or mourning, often both, the passing of somebody. And so that one is quite natural. When people get married, a lot of the time it's quite good to ask them why. And in the whole, you'll probably be able to account for this, Crystal, in the whole arranging of it, it becomes a little bit more like an event that you are coordinating. And in amongst that, I think it's very easy for people to forget perhaps why they might be doing that. And so one of the greatest parts of my job is I get to ask people to stop and think and reflect. And then extraordinarily, people share that with me. So I guess one of the main things I love about my job is the fact that I go from an unknown email with just strangers' names to a certain point in time where I've been given an incredible amount of intimate information that is entrusted in me, and I get to then celebrate, retell that story, explain it, however it may be.
Asking couples to think about the why behind marriage or celebrating their union in whatever way that looks like for them is so important, because as you say, people often start with the what and the how, and it's almost like the reverse concentric circles of start with the why. And asking people why they want to do it, what that union means to them, almost what their core values are, then allows you to have a really good filter as to what is important or not important to you as you're deciding what cutlery you want to have or who you want to invite or all of these kind of pieces, that instead of becoming everything that it symbolizes, become an outcome of those decisions that you've made about the why. So I think it's so amazing that you ask those kind of questions, and also you become so embedded within the couple as well in a really beautiful way, and you always reinforce that people should make sure that they have space and time to enjoy each other and reflect seriously about what that commitment means to them and how they want to be treated throughout. And I think it's extremely special.
It's really interesting in a wedding, because it's actually not about the day. It's about the marriage, and it's not just about the marriage, it's about what came before it. And I guess this is perhaps why ceremony exists in the first place. And when you look back and see why it does it exist, it's because it's going to help you annotate a moment in time in which you can probably articulate things that you perhaps wouldn't articulate on any other given Saturday and or any day of the week. And so the need for these things is very inherent and deep-rooted in human beings, I think, that you don't just do something for the sake of it. And feasting and celebration need a focus point. That's where they grow from, rather than the other way around. And if you lose sight of what the focus point is, it's quite easy to lose sight of all the important things. So the practice that I get to do with couples, especially in a wedding context, is very much about just asking people to stop still and think, and ask difficult questions as well, not just the easy questions, because these are all about the foundations of where you're about to move off from. And I do revel in how storytelling, which so often we think is a fictional or an imaginary concept, but it isn't. Storytelling is about how we interact with each other, how we empathize with one another, how we learn about each other. And so our real stories are the things that evolve into being able to be a story that you then share with other people, which hopefully you experienced is also a way of developing a relationship with other people that perhaps you didn't have before. By making yourself intimate in front of people, it's quite a vulnerable thing to do, but from that comes a lot of strength. And I think just going into something that is a rite of passage and a ceremony that is just a script that doesn't really have anything to do with what you're doing, and you're just echoing empty old words, is neither here nor there. That's not really the point. You can sign a piece of paper really quickly. The act of marriage, that what's going to come from it, is much more than just showing of a passport and names on a piece of paper. And so it should be considered, and it should be reveled in, and it should be awkward and excruciating and magnificent all at the same time.
So for anyone who perhaps controversially doesn't enjoy weddings or wedding ceremonies specifically, then you need to find out more about Zena, because I actually really hated wedding ceremonies and didn't really enjoy weddings until I went to a wedding where she was the celebrant, well, not my own, and it completely turned what I thought a wedding ceremony could be on its head. And
I think it might help that I didn't like weddings either. I didn't get into this because I had a scrapbook that I'd been creating since I was 14. On the contrary, I kind of very, very much felt that weddings especially left me quite cold. And when, I think we touched on this at the beginning, when I was asked by some friends of mine if I would marry them, it's a big honour when you're asked something like that, but I had absolutely no idea what I was doing. Part of the reason they did actually ask me, and we've joked about this since, is they went through their guest list and they thought, who doesn't mind speaking out loud? Who is good at writing? and who is really nerdy, so it's going to do some research for us. And that was me. And as I looked into ceremony, that's what interested me. And it was only a wedding because it was what they had asked me to do. I actually did bring with me one of my favorite quotes about marriage. I'm going to share it with you if that's okay, because I was once allowed by a very brave bride to read this in their wedding, and once by an extremely brave groom. They're the only two people who've let me read it before, but it was allegedly spoken by Tina Modetti, who was good friends with Frida Kahlo. And she used this as she spoke to Frida about her upcoming marriage. And everything about this, it's in the second but, okay? So she said, "I don't believe in marriage. I think at worst, it's a hostile political act, a way for small-minded men to keep women in the house and out of the way, wrapped up in the guise of tradition and conservative religious nonsense. At best, it's a happy delusion. These two people who truly love each other and have no idea how truly miserable they're about to make each other. But, when two people know that and they decide with eyes wide open to face each other and get married anyway, then I don't think it's conservative or delusional. I think it's radical and courageous and very romantic." And what I loved about discovering that is it was how I had felt as I made my way through learning about people's weddings. I'm not a big advocate for marriage. I think people are entirely entitled to live their lives precisely how they want to. But if you decide that you would like to get married, then you have to think about why. And you have to do it with your eyes wide open, and you have to be brave about it. Because that's the only way, I think, in modern life, you're going to be able to hopefully have a long, fruitful and joyful marriage.
Actually, you change, for me, transform wedding ceremonies into more of an anthropological act, or that becomes a human interest story that anybody would be interested in, the understanding of how these two people have come, you know, united in some way. And I think that's what makes it so magical and fascinating.
And when you're not holding yourself accountable to a deity, which in theory you're not, then you are actually holding yourself accountable to people whose opinions matter to you. Your community, your network, your friends, your family. And that accountability needs to matter, and it needs to mean something. And so you want everybody to understand what they're agreeing to hold you accountable to. And hopefully in amongst all that, it's also really interesting and fun. And yeah, that's what I explore.
You mentioned it being your practice, which I've never heard a celebrant or someone who brings people together. Could you talk or unpack that a little bit? Because I'm actually quite fascinated by that notion that you see this as a practice, so something in development constantly.
Yeah, no, absolutely it is. And I think one of the first things that I realized when I started doing this job, which I think as you get older is one of the greatest gifts anything can give you, is that I stopped being able to make assumptions. So I am essentially just meeting, especially on first meet, I meet people who's just, I just have names. Sometimes I might have an insightful email address. So I can start making assumptions, which are about to be blown out the water almost every single time. And for me, when I work with people, I can't just go along thinking I know what's about to happen, because it's important to me when I'm creating a ceremony that I am creating a ceremony that represents who I am talking to or who I've been asked to stand up in front of. And as such, over the years and continually, and I guess that's why I'm still as fascinated by it as I was from the first day I did this, and I've been doing it for just coming up to 9 years, is that I never really know what pathway I'm about to go down. I have acquired skills and tools as I go, which I know that I can help. But if I arrive, especially, again, I'm going to focus this probably on weddings, but if I arrive thinking, well, I know how your ceremony is going to be, one, where's the fun in that for me? And two, what a lie. I haven't listened. It's about listening. And ceremony itself is evolving consistently in my head. I'm always fascinated by what its purpose is. I think in a lot of ways it's, again, with weddings in particular, people think it's about themselves. They think it's about the couple. It's actually an opportunity to be very outward looking and to be full of gratitude. And you get to be out loud grateful in a way that we don't get to do very often. And I think, again, this is actually what the kernel of a rite of passage can often be. It's about taking stock of where you are and where you've come from, where you're hoping to go, and who the people are who have made up that tapestry so far. So when I look forward, actually, I'm going to interrupt myself. I met a woman couple of years ago, and last year I got to know her a little bit more, called Tudor Hahn. And she talked about being a ritual practitioner or a ritual expert. I pull back from the phrase expert because I think as we're constantly evolving, you just keep learning. And I always want there to be someone I can be learning from. When you look at ritual, you see that it has a purpose, a symbolic action, or a way of expressing something that sometimes words are a little bit more difficult to cover. And I think within ceremony, it very often goes hand in hand with ritual. So I work predominantly in weddings, but as a practice, understanding ceremony, understanding ritual, it evolves consistently. And I would never have been brave enough a few years ago to have thought that I was able to help create a ceremony for a purpose other than one that had already been prescribed to me. So I feel very comfortable. I'm trained to do weddings. I'm trained to do funerals. I'm trained to do namings. But slowly but surely, you realize that you have a toolkit that is more valuable than you realized. And sort of harking back to what I said about January and an invented ceremony, we only called it a reclamation ceremony so that there was something to put at the top of an email. But it did actually become something that explained what we did. A very good friend of mine had moved to another country, and she had a partner who was going to be moving out with her later. But when she arrived there, it transpired, without going into too much detail, that it made an awful lot of sense for her to buy a flat rather than rent a flat. And so she was very nervous about doing this, but there was no financial problem. It's Holland. They're amazing. You basically can get a 100%+ mortgage and you don't really have to lose any money. And so it became a very empowering thing for her to be able to buy this flat. And she did it by herself. And I remember because we Skyped and FaceTimed her going and looking at places. Anyway, so her partner eventually moved over and moved with her. And then after 2 years, they broke up. And I understood and empathized with so much of her sadness, obviously. But one thing she kept saying was that her flat didn't feel like her home anymore because it was theirs. And it was the one point where I thought, I'm going to have to interject, because it was yours. You did share it, but ultimately you got it on your own. And so in the course of our discussions, what transpired is that whenever she opened the front door, her house just didn't feel like hers anymore. It felt like it was missing the absence of the other person. And that's completely normal and as it should be. But she just started working from home as well. So suddenly this space that was holding so much more of her time wasn't the space that she felt the most comfortable and the most secure in. And so I felt like that we needed to do something about that. So I don't think anyone should banish their past. I'm quite a big believer in that. I think you just own your past and you look at it and you stare directly down the barrel of the gun at the things that scare the life out of you. And so with the idea of reclaiming her space, I didn't want to banish any of her past memories. So what I thought the best thing to do would be to get in touch with all the people that she'd met in the country that she'd moved to. So I got her to give me a list of the sort of top tier of people who had been really important to her in the past 2.5 years. And I asked her very nicely if she'd let me write to them. So weird me wrote to them and asked them to tell me how their lives had changed since she had arrived, to tell me about their favourite memories that they had with her, and mostly to tell me their favourite memories they had with her in her apartment. And then we did a series of three things. The first thing we did was she wanted to sage her apartment. Now, I take a lot of my belief in things from science, and so the idea of saging and her maybe wanting me to be some sort of shamanic leader really made me kind of creep away a little. But I learned that when you sage a space, the smoke collects 94% of all airborne bacteria. So there's a very scientific background to cleansing a space. So I was all for that. But we didn't want to do it all po-faced. So I got her best friend to come over and we just saged each of the rooms. And as an action, it's actually really interesting because you have to open the windows and you go to each corner and then you waft the smoke back out. There is an extraordinary physicality that goes with that, which people often don't realise can have an amazing mental effect to you when you do something physical like that. Then I invited her six friends to come, and it just so happened that her apartment had six rooms, which was perfect. And I got her to say the two things that were niggles in the room, the two things that she loved about the room and her intention for the room. And then we put one person in each of those rooms and they shared their memories of her, their memories of what, how their life has changed a little bit by her, and their memories within the apartment, which basically means that there's no way each of those rooms isn't now superseded by that memory. And all of this is really just to say that a lot of the time ceremony is just about people expressing gratitude, and that reminds us of our presence, not our past or our future, but our real presence. And then the third part of the ceremony was everyone she knew came, and one of her niggles is that the flat, now that it's empty, makes a lot of noise. She hears noise everywhere, so I got absolutely everybody to make more noise than you could possibly ever make in one space. So the next time she hears a small noise, she can hear all the noise that we made. I would never have been able to have done something like that if I hadn't been working on this as a practice. Because I would have felt possibly embarrassed, like what you were saying earlier about the bragging rights. I do sort of step very backwards instead of forwards when I find myself in those sorts of positions. But when you realise that you have a certain toolkit that can aid and make things a little nicer, a little bit better, which in my friend's case is what we did with this ceremony, it was a really extraordinary revelation to me. But not in terms of how I know that as a job, this is something that is constantly evolving. And the best part of it is that everything I learn from people that I meet, which may spark things in my brain. I might help bring an idea forward. But ultimately, all of that, the genesis comes from what I learn from other people. And so going just briefly back to the fact that it teaches you to let go of your assumptions. Yeah, there's no way I can meet someone and find out what their profession is and then think, that's fine, I've got you bagged now. I know how to do your ceremony. I won't have a clue.
That sounds beautiful, that ceremony. And so joyous as well. What I can tell in your practice is that you really think about the individual, but also think about how ceremony and ritual can then marry, want of a better word, marry with that person in terms of, you know, their personality or their history or, you know, their kind of life's journey. It's beautiful.
And about community too, bringing together community, because I think ceremony, it can exist in a really intimate level. It could just be, I could have just married you and Chris, for example, but it's a different experience when you then invite your greater community in to witness that. And so I like to think that the process that we worked on was the intimacy of your decision. And then the actual event itself was the expression of it, the outward expression.
The day is just a kind of a happy outcome of a process that brings you closer to that person and more consciously aware of the decision that you're making.
But I'm laughing because I love weddings. Like, yeah. I love them, but I have no intention of ever getting married. Never have. And I love seeing people marking a point in time. And I just, I get all lovey, get teary at them. I think they're fabulous.
Can we do a kind of, can Zina come and do a home birthday celebration for your amazing house in Lyon-Sea that everybody loves?
Why don't we do a 100th episode marking with
Zina? Yes!
Definitely do that.
That's amazing.
Because we're at 62. We'll hit 100 before the end of the year when we've achieved all our New Year's resolutions.
Yes.
We will have homework, and so long as you're all good with homework, let's do it.
That'd be good.
Yes. All good with homework. So now, just to absolutely trivialise this conversation to shit, let's talk about Valentine's Day from serious...
No, I love Valentine's Day.
Okay.
I'm quite opinionated about Valentine's Day as well, but maybe
it sounds like
reason.
We have all of the right people in the room to share their views on Valentine's Day. So... Renee, my beautiful co-host, please tell me, share with me what you love or loathe. I don't know your personal opinion about Valentine's Day.
Going back to what you were just talking about, ritual and ceremony, what I love is that there's a day in the calendar that's marked to celebrate love. I love that. I think that's fantastic, and I think we should reflect on that. Of course, especially because we work in the media and comms industries, it has been bastardized a little bit. But the thought of like, oh, it's Valentine's Day and I'm thinking of these people, my partner or my friends, and giving them a gift, no matter how small, it can just be a note to say, hey, just thinking of you and I really love you. I think that's great that we have that as a day. Hopefully we do it more than once a year, but I do love there's a point, a reflection time, a stop to go, this day honours love, whether that be platonic or romantic. It's a day to just honour loving.
Or self-love.
Self-love, yeah.
Zina Birch, what is your view on Valentine's Day?
Well, I just wanted to respond briefly to that because I love that you said platonic love as well. I just love that, you know, there are so many different variations of love and it shouldn't always just be about romantic love. Love in its varied capacity should be celebrated every day correctly. my opinion on Valentine's Day is quite similar, but I kind of think couples need to be excluded from Valentine's Day. I think Valentine's Day is for wooers. And I've always loved that. You know, as I was growing up, Valentine's Day was for the single folk. Valentine's Day was the day that you were allowed, in theory, to let your intentions be known. It was full of jeopardy because it might be rejected, but you were brave enough on this day. It was in a carefully thought through card that might have some very clever words in it that just had a question mark or a your secret admirer. And for that, I love it in its existence. So I see that there is, commercially, it becomes something bigger than it perhaps needs to be. And people can become cynical about it. And maybe it's more difficult to get dinner reservations. And maybe they're more expensive than they need to be. And you could be going out for dinner on any given night of the week. But I like it in its purest form, in that it was the day you got to be a bit braver.
Mm. Mm. How has your New Year's resolution around being open to love gone?
I did
so
listen
far?
To that last month.
I'm very open, but January has been busy. I really see that as a little bit later in the year because I'm on target on the two other.
Great.
New Year's resolution.
I'm proud of you. That's
good. I'm
going
to sideswipe you. You can't plan it. That's one thing my job has definitely taught me, is that there's no formula and there's no right way, and the brilliance of not knowing what's around the corner. You know, I see that all the time. Mm. People never saw it round the next corner.
My personal stance on Valentine's Day, not that anybody asked, but I'm just going to go for
Crystal,
it anyway.
What's your personal stance on Valentine's Day?
Well, I think anybody who knows me well will know that I'm actually quite a gushy, loving person. And to the people that I'm close to, I show my love and affection all the time throughout the year in lots of little ways. So actually, I'd prefer not to have something on Valentine's Day because it feels forced in a way, or it feels like that thought hasn't come independently, but it's from something else. But anytime that you receive any form of affection or somebody communicates that they're thinking about you, it is a wonderful and beautiful thing. And if that happens to be on Valentine's Day, then that's brilliant. And if Valentine's Day is the prompt for somebody to do that, then I'm all for it.
Listeners, Crystal bought me a red rose tonight.
Aww.
It's true. And those tulips are for you because you love dying tulips.
I do. I think they're the most slutty of all the flowers. And I love that. As they die, they splay. And they just look so resplendent in their demise that how can you not love them more? I wanted to just quickly say that that's another reason why Valentine's Day is brilliant for the single, because it's full of surprise. Mm. And if you're expecting roses from your partner because it's Valentine's Day, it feels a little transactory. But actually, when it's in the realm of the unexpected, that's where it has its magic.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's Valentine's Day is a great opportunity to spark joy, and people should try to do that all throughout the year. But if you don't manage to, then do it on Valentine's Day, and that is great.
And in lives where we're all so full of identity, how brilliant is it to post something with just a question mark inside? Do it. Everybody do it.
I think the way that love, and particularly Valentine's Day, is treated in the media has the potential to, at its worst, make people feel quite isolated and alone when it feels like everybody else around them is posting couples photos or the gazillion red roses that they're partner may or may not have bought them. But on the other hand, I think there are some really brilliant accounts on Instagram, for example, and elsewhere, where there are some really positive messages around what Valentine's Day can mean, or any moments of significance or holidays throughout the year where, if you're alone, there are some nice ways to celebrate that moment and mark it in a positive way. I think Option B is amazing at doing that. I don't know if anyone follows that as part of the Sheryl Sandberg Foundation, but there's some really brilliant posts on how to cope if you're experiencing grief on days like Valentine's Day, and some really practical advice for people who are struggling at a time where the rest of the world is seemingly in love and gushing and celebrating. So how do you think Valentine's Day is treated in the media at its best?
At its best, I think quite simply what Renee said, which is just the celebration of love itself. And I find it interesting when you say, like, you know, if you feel alone, being alone is a magnificent thing. I think it's quite often that the media, that society represents solo people as being the poor, unfortunate others. And I don't actually personally agree with that. You know, if we can't find our own comfortability with ourselves on our own, then, you know, everything else is going to be a struggle. And you can be in a partnership and feel deeply alone. So I think one of the best things, I guess, about Valentine's Day is this celebration that you don't have to be in a couple for you to be able to manifest intention, and that it doesn't just have to be romantic love. And you do find, even in, you know, places like Paper Chase, it's not actually just your classic romantic boyfriend girlfriend love that you see on the cards anymore. And I think that's a really positive step forward.
I agree, actually. I think that Paper Chase in particular, their cards are brilliant, to the extent that I actually have just started hoarding the selection that they have of Valentine's Day to give as birthday cards. Because there's some really good ones, like You're the Person That I Love to Annoy the Most, and things that just are a bit more real than like I love you because blah, 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 blah. I'm just going to give everyone Valentine's Day cards for every occasion, because I think there's a bit more tongue-in-cheek humour around it now, which I really appreciate.
There's definitely more humour.
I think as well, in terms of advertising and within the media, it's anyone who takes the piss out of or subverts the stereotypes. That has my attention. If I'm seeing the same old boy meets girl, roses, chocolates, oh, so boring, like done to death. So, yeah, I always look out for anyone that's, like, done a quirky take on Valentine's Day. Got my attention.
Yeah, exactly like a You're the Only Person I Would Share My Chicken McNuggets With type vibe, or vegan chicken
You could offer me as many nuggets as you want. I'm never going to be yours.
Although, I actually really need to tell you both about something, because there's this amazing company called This, and they have made meat-free chicken nuggets, which actually taste incredible, to the extent that I've only tried it once, and I actually had a craving for it, like, 2 weeks later, and would rather have that than a chicken nugget. And I don't even like chicken nuggets that much, but it's really, really great.
So. By the end of 2020, Crystal's going to be vegan.
Yes, I really am. So another area that I would love to explore is whether we think that being in love has impacted or not impacted creativity. And do you think there are any myths or preconceptions around this?
Oh, you could argue that all creativity may only exist because of love. And by that, I mean unrequited love is one of the greatest precursors to creativity. You could also argue that love helps heighten us. So I guess even just on a chemical level, that sense of wonder, that sense of wanting to share, that feeling of real presence in the world can often be heightened by any of the great emotions, actually. Sorrow, love, fear, all of these things heighten us. But you can't deny that love has definitely helped create some dreadful things and some wonderful things.
Maybe this is my own preconception, but I think it's the opposite. Like, sometimes a good dose of, you know, self-loathing or sadness can be a great fuel for creativity. But I might be conflating creativity with determination and focus as opposed to creativity in and of itself. But I think you're right in that any heightened state of emotion can allow you to create work that you can't necessarily get to unless you're at that perhaps extreme of emotion or not. But I tend to really disassociate the feeling of being in love with work, actually. They tend to be quite separate in my mind, which is probably where I would say that I'm less creative. I know you're going to shout at me, Renee.
No, not true. I find being in love very distracting.
Yeah.
And quite frustrating when I need to make work.
Yeah, exactly.
And so I have to really negotiate and walk that.
Yeah, yeah, completely. And I think actually, for me, being in love and working to coexist actually requires a high level of compartmentalization in that, and sometimes that can be the difficult adjustment period, which is where there is sometimes arguments, which is that window between getting home from work where you still have your work skin on and then the person that you are to your partner or even a friend. I don't think it just has to be a romantic partner, but that can sometimes be a bit jarring because you're not the person that you're partner expects you to be when you're still wearing that skin sometimes and you're still in a kind of efficiency mode. And I often find that that's the time where there can be arguments because of that mismatch of expectation. And the only way I can really, you know, I find it really difficult if I'm working from home or doing work and Chris is around to like still be affectionate because my brain is so in work mode. And I find those things quite difficult to coexist. personally. So, have either of you had any experience of your relationship status impacting how you are considered or perceived or how you feel in a workplace environment?
I'm probably contradictory again in this, because somebody said to me the other day, a fellow celebrant, they said to me, oh, I always assumed there was a Mr. Zena. And there isn't. I'm single and happily single, mainly out of choice at present. I'm always going to say mainly out of choice because we don't know what's around any corner. But I am very happily living as a single woman. What I found is the opposite of that, because I work in a love environment and I'm often celebrating other people's relationships. Sometimes people find it quite astounding or extraordinary or curious or odd that I'm not married myself. And I think, going back to when you are in love, there's so many different versions of that, the first of which should always get in the way of work, because it's essentially, as Shakespeare said, a temporary madness. It's all consuming. It's going to use up all of those bits of your brain that you don't really want to be consumed because you're busy or you want to carry on with the things that you're impassioned about, but sometimes falling in pesky love can get in the way of that. So I think it's funny that I work in the industry of love, I will say in very inverted commas, and yet I'm currently not married myself, which I don't find odd at all, but it's wonderful watching great Uncle George's eyebrow raise when he suddenly notices I don't have a wedding ring on my finger.
What about you, Crystal?
I think it impacts in as well. There are a couple of ways in which I've seen that manifest itself or experience it personally. One is the kind of association with youth that I can think can be unhelpful, that sometimes being married can, just by its association, give you a bit more gravitas or feel like it can give you more gravitas. I'm still at the point where I'm just about not cringing when I say that I'm married out loud or that I say I have a husband. But I think there's almost that shift that happens where people can no longer be like, oh, you know, can I use your Tinder account? Can I go in and have a bit of fun with your Tinder account? That all of those signals, something we've talked about a lot, is the signals that denote certain things about who you are that then have an impact on how you're perceived in the workplace. And I think sometimes single women in particular, there's a kind of expectation, or it's seen to be okay for people to ask about their weekends or their dating experiences or any funny dates that they've been on recently, almost as like office conversation. And actually, I personally think that that is a way of systematically undermining that person's seniority role in that room, unless it's kind of offered freely or kind of really consented to, because actually it's saying, oh, you're young, you're not settled, you're kind of in some way perhaps not complete. And I just think it can be quite dangerous. That sounds like a really serious answer there, but it is, because I just think it can be a way to trivialize. And I also think it can be quite dangerous in terms of not allowing people to set boundaries when you're either single or you're dating somebody. I think in some ways your need to get home is somehow perceived as less than somebody who is married and has children, making it harder for people to draw boundaries. And I think where women in particular want to please and do the right thing and go the extra mile, sometimes that can be a signal that is taken advantage of. So not all of those things are based on my personal experience, but I just think they are things that happen. And what about you, Renee?
I agree with both of you, because I don't think it should matter, but I definitely read situations and there is an expectation that you share this information, divulge. I'm an extremely private person and I set very clear boundaries. I won't talk about relationships at work. Mm-hmm. It's very rare I would do that with anyone. I'd like to keep it very separate. But there is judgments made, whether you, especially I am happily single. I love my spending time by myself. I love what I do in life. I celebrate that and I am very happy, and it won't be forever. So I enjoy it while it's here. Mm. But I definitely have been in situations, especially meeting with clients, going out with clients in the evening. That is pretty much the question that gets served up early on.
Mm.
And I definitely feel judgments made.
Mm.
And not because I have any insecurity around that, because I really don't. So I think it does come into play, unfortunately.
Mm.
I guess it's how you deal with it.
So what I've loved about today is that we've really explored how love can manifests itself in different ways, from grandiose acts to small, tiny acts of bravery. And they can be for yourself or for your parents or your friends or somebody that you don't know. So what I'd encourage everybody to do in this wonderful month of February and on their 14th, if you so wish, is to just do a small, kind act for somebody else or for yourself, because it's a nice thing to do and it's a great way to send a message to the world. And on the topic of small brave acts, I'm excited to give you a little teaser that next month we will be having our first ever male voice on the podcast ever. And we wouldn't save this accolade for just anyone. We have one of my absolute favourite human beings, Sam Conniff, joining us to discuss many things, including his latest project, Professional Rule Breaking. Thank you so much, Zina, for being part of this panel. It's been an absolute joy to have you here.
My pleasure.
And Renee, always a pleasure.
Crystal, always a pleasure. With huge love.
So much love and pleasure.
And also to our lovely, lovely listeners, we are sending you love next week on the 14th of February.
That's amazing. I love that. That's good.
Or question mark. Was it you?
Every listener will be getting a question mark card from me.
Yeah. Yeah. If you get a love letter in the post with a question mark, it's from
Renee.
Email
me your postal address.